Well, Mr. Zimmerman inspired me today to bring some water. Those deacons really need to get on the ball and do their job here. Well, hope everyone's having a wonderful Sabbath. Want to welcome our visitors. Glad to have you here with us. Hope we're all getting settled in from the feast. It's enjoyable being able to share feast stories and share our experiences. I came across a story that I'd like to share with you today. I found this in a book by Malcolm Gladwell called David and Goliath. There was a man named Vivek Renadive who found himself coaching his 12-year-old daughter's basketball team. This was national junior basketball, basically the little league of basketball. Renadive was from Mumbai and had never played basketball before. He grew up with cricket and soccer. The first time he saw a basketball game played, he said that he thought it was mindless. This is his description. A team A would score and then immediately retreat to its own end of the court. Team B would pass the ball from the sidelines and dribble it into Team A's to Team A's end, where Team A was patiently waiting, and the process would just reverse itself. He noted that a regulation basketball court is 94 feet long. Most of the time, a team would only defend about 24 feet of that, conceding the other 70 feet. Occasionally, teams played full court press. That is, they contested the opponent's attempt to advance the ball up the court, but they only did it for a few minutes at a time. He felt it was as if there were some sort of conspiracy in basketball where the game wasn't played the way it ought to be played. Renadive thought that conspiracy had the effect of widening the gap between good teams and weak teams. Good teams, after all, had players who were tall and could dribble and shoot well. They could crisply execute their carefully prepared plays in their opponent's end of the court. Why, then, did weak teams play in a way that made it easy for the good teams to do the very thing that they were good at? Renadive looked at his girls. He only had two who actually had played basketball before. But most of them, including his own daughter, had never played the game. They weren't at all tall. They couldn't shoot. He said they weren't exactly adept at dribbling. He said that they weren't the type that would go out to the playground in the evenings and get pickup games. He said that his team was made up of little blonde girls, as he would put it in his words. These were the daughters of nerds and computer programmers. They worked on science projects and read long, complicated books. He said these were the type of kids that would dream of growing up and being marine biologists. Renadive knew that if he played the conventional game of basketball, that his opponents would beat him up, that he would most certainly lose, especially against girls that played basketball with a passion. Renadive came to America as a 17-year-old with $50 in his pocket. He was not about to lose easily. His approach was that his team would play a real full-court press every game, all the time. The team ended up making it to the national championship. Renadive's basketball team played the National Junior Basketball 7th and 8th grade division, representing Rosewood City. Rosewood City, their strategy was built around the two rule or the two deadlines that all basketball teams must meet in order to advance the ball. The first is the time allotted for the inbounds pass. When one team scores, a player from the other team takes the ball out of bounds and has 5 seconds to pass it to a teammate inside the court. If that deadline is missed, the ball goes to the other team. Usually that's not an issue because teams don't hang around to defend against the inbounds pass. they run back to their own end of the court. Redwood City did not do that. Each girl on the team closely shadowed her counterpart. When some teams play the press, the defender plays behind the offensive player she's guarding in order to impede her once she's caught the ball. Redwood City girls, by contrast, played a more aggressive, high-risk strategy. They positioned themselves in front of the other opponents to prevent them from catching the inbounds pass in the first place. And they didn't have anyone guard the player that was throwing the ball in. Renadive used that player as a floater who could serve as a second defender against the other team's most valuable player or best player. As often as not, the teams Redwood City was playing against couldn't make the inbound passes within the 5-second limit, or else the inbound player would panic and throw the ball away in fear of her 5 seconds running out. Renadive says that his girls would play this way. They would intercept the passes and push these girls and press these girls, and they were so intense because they knew what their one job was. He said the second deadline, or the second rule in basketball, requires a team to advance a ball across midcourt into their opponent's end within 10 seconds. And if Redwood City's opponents met that first deadline and were able to make that inbound pass in times, the girls would turn their attention immediately to that second deadline. They would descend on the girl who caught the ball, all of them, on the inbounds pass, and they would trap her, stretching out their arms high and wide. Maybe they could steal the ball. Maybe they would cause her to panic and throw the ball away. Or maybe she would panic again and the 10 seconds would run out and they would have the ball. They would press and steal and do the same thing over and over again. It made people nervous. It made all of the other team nervous. It made the other coaches mad and furious with them. They didn't feel they were playing actual basketball. Because Redwood City typically got the ball underneath the opponent's basket, they rarely had to attempt low-percentage, long-range shots that required skill and practice. They simply were able to shoot layups. What that defense did for them is that they could hide their weaknesses. Because as long as they played hard on defense, they were getting steals and getting easy layups. Renadive said, "My girls had to be more fit than any of the others. I would make them run, run, and run." He said that he didn't have time to teach them, and he personally didn't have the skills to teach them what they would need to know to compete in a regular basketball game. He just taught them the basics of the game. He said that's why attitude or heart was so important to play with him, because it plays such a big role. He said, because you're going to get tired, and you've got to make sure that you have the right attitude. Their team cheer was 1-2-3 attitude. The whole Redwood City philosophy was based on a willingness to try harder than anyone else, and it worked. One time, a new girl joined the team, and Renadive said that he was concerned that the new girl wouldn't get the whole attitude thing. And one time, as soon as they had the team cheer, she said, no, it's not 1-2-3 attitude. It's 1-2-3 attitude, huh. And so I knew he had the right girl. There is indeed a certain attitude that we need to have as Christians. And it's not about what we can't do or what we don't have, but rather it is about what we can do and what we do have. We have to make sure as Christians that's the attitude and approach that we take. What many saw as Redwood City's disadvantage turned out to be actually their greatest advantage, because their lack of skill made them willing to work even harder. The story of Redwood basketball team highlights the value of a fresh perspective, unconventional thinking, hard work, and the right attitude and the right heart. We can see some of these principles in the story of David and Goliath. So today, that's what we're going to be focusing on. We're going to be going through the story of David and Goliath and seeing some of the lessons that we can take away and learn and to apply to ourselves as Christians as we go through this life. As we look at our daily battles, living in the world but apart from it, since we're not to be of the world, we will never be comfortable in this world. And we'll always face continual pressures as long as we're here living in this world. As we look to the future, and as all of us have commented to one another and noticing, the world is growing darker and crazier, seems like every day. Seems like we tend to find hostilities in places that didn't seem to be there before. The world is growing more hostile, and it will grow more hostile towards us as Christians. But we can all be called Davids. We can all be called Davids. God has called each of us to be a David. To look at those giants, and God has called us to be Davids, to look at those giants and not just be willing to battle them, but to be enthusiastic about it and to be confident in the victory that God will give to us. So the title for the message today is, we are all Davids in a world of Goliaths. We are all Davids in a world of Goliaths. We'll spend most of our time in 1 Samuel 17, and we'll draw out some lessons through this story as we go through it. As we go along, I'll mention four advantages that David had, and these are the same advantages that apply to us. So as we look at the advantages that David had in his battle, they're the same thing that help us in our battle. Most importantly, the most important thing that I want to leave us with today is this simple statement, is the battle is the Lord's. And as we conclude here today, we'll read David's words saying that, the battle is the Lord's. So starting in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1, 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered together in Soko, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Soko and Zika. I practiced all these names and I knew this would happen. In Zika, in Ephes and Dummim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on one mountainside, and Israel stood on the other mountainside, with the valley between them. The valley of Elah is within a series of ridges and valleys connecting the Judean mountains to the east, with a wide flat expanse that expands to the Mediterranean plain in the region. And this is of great strategic importance because over the century, numerous battles have been fought for it, for control of it, because this valley is a clear pathway to Bethlehem and Jerusalem in the Judean highlands. So this is a place that many battles have been fought over for control. I have a quote here from Malcolm Gladwell, his book David and Goliath. The Philistines set up camp along the southern ridge of Elah. The Israelites pitched their tents on one side along the northern ridge, which left the two armies looking across the ravine at each other. Neither dared to move to attack. It meant descending down the hill and making a suicidal climb up the enemy's ridge on the other side. So we have these two armies on either side of a mountain, on opposite sides of a mountain with a ridge in between, and neither can attack the other because the other will be given the advantage immediately. And so here we are. we have the setting of the story of David and Goliath. What we're looking at is a conventional battle array, army facing off against army. And this is how things were done. So continuing on in verse 4. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of that coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. Goliath, a giant. It said that he was over 9 feet tall. Some commentaries say that he could have been as tall as 11 to 12 feet. And he was seemingly as strong and powerful as he was big. They referred to him as a champion. He was a trained, experienced warrior. He is the one, after all, the Philistines put out. They decided to use him to put forward for the battle. They had that much confidence in him. One thing to keep in mind, and as we read through verses 4 through 7, it describes his armor and his weaponry. He had the most modern armor and weaponry of the time. This was a modern warrior. When you look at the different commentaries that talk about his armor, and especially his javelin and shaft, they're quite impressive. His heavy metal helmet protected his head, his neck, the sides of his face. The coat of mail he wore, by most estimates, weighed over 150 pounds. His legs were also protected by his armor, leaving very little of his body exposed to attack. He carried both a javelin and a spear, and the spear would leave enemies awestruck. The head of the spear was made of iron. It is estimated that it weighed about 18 pounds. One historian wrote this: to the Israelites, this extraordinary spear with its heavy shaft plus long, heavy iron blade would, when hurled by Goliath's strong arm, seemed capable of piercing any bronze shield and bronze armor together. Goliath here is the perfect picture of power and strength. Any soldier looking at him from across this valley would think there's no way that a normal man would go up and challenge him and defeat him. You and I, as Christians, can relate to this in our own lives. We come against these same adversaries, whether people or situations, whatever they are, that seem unbeatable, that seem to be something that there's no way we could challenge. And that's what the Israelites were looking at here. They were seeing something through their eyes that they didn't think they could overcome. Continuing on in verse 8. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel, and he said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself. Let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Goliath puts forward this challenge, a single combat challenge. This was a common practice in the ancient world. Two sides in a conflict would seek to avoid the heavy bloodshed of open battle by choosing one warrior to represent them in a duel. The side whose warrior won the duel would be considered the winner of the battle, and the fight was supposed to end there. Here they were looking across this ravine at each other. Neither army daring to charge at the other, and you have Goliath coming out taunting the Israelites. Goliath said, "I defy the armies of Israel today." He was insulting them. He was railing against them. He was provoking them. And if they took this to heart, it would have been tearing them down, tearing away at their courage and breaking any spirit that they had. That's what happens to us when we look at our Goliaths in our lives and we listen to what's being said, or we pay attention to the taunts that are giving to us. It tears us down. And that's what happened to Israel. It's what happened to Saul. Verse 11. When Saul and all the Israelites heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Goliath's taunts beat them down. They discouraged him. They truly were terrified. They were terrified of him. In the typical view, hand-to-hand combat, single combat that Goliath was asking for, who could beat Goliath? He was a terrifying opponent. And he had the most sophisticated weaponry. Among Israel, there was only this conventional thinking. They saw only what was on the surface and what appeared to be the situation. God was not part of their thinking. So they couldn't imagine a solution because they didn't bring God into their thinking. They didn't think that God would supply a solution. So faith in what God could do for them wasn't present. They were just scared and terrified. Skipping down to verse 16. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. This challenge went on for 40 days, twice a day. 80 times this army watched Goliath come out and taunt them, ridicule them, probably with a very foul mouth, being creative with how he could try to intimidate them, just insulting them one morning to evening after another. Apparently, all these 40 days, the entire army would go out, get ready for battle, and then Goliath would repeat this challenge and nothing would happen. Hearing this defiance day after day, these insults against them, and the boasting about how he was unbeatable in his strength, that would wear anybody down. And it did. It wore the whole army down. But someone with a different view, a different heart, also you might say a different attitude, entered the picture. Verse 17. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their thousand and see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel who were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. This battle had just been sitting here in a holding pattern for 40 days, over a month. Two armies staring across the valley at each other, going out to fight, shouting for battle, making a racket, just repeating this and repeating this. Nothing changing. No one stepping up to the challenge. No one questioning the status quo. Everyone was too fearful, and nobody had any plans to do anything different. Verse 22. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper and ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. Then he talked with them. There was the champion, the Philistine Goliath, by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. The fear has become overwhelming. David came there and he saw that there was no hope. Skipping down to verse 26. Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" You get the feeling that David is confused about how this could even be happening. David's not looking at things the same way everybody else is. He's looking at them quite a bit differently. Like the basketball coach, he's like a foreigner coming in, never having played the game before. He hasn't been conditioned by these last 40 days of taunts and insults morning and evening. And you get the idea that as soon as David hears this, he's not about to hear it again. He said, "Who is this Philistine who defies the armies of the living God?" He recognized who was being insulted here. David said, "He defies the armies of the living God." This Goliath was challenging God. And David could see that right away. That was the first thing he noticed. And David knew that Goliath was no match for God. And he recognized that. But for some reason, nobody else did. Nobody else recognized this fact. So advantage, the first advantage of David and for us is clear vision. Clear vision. David saw through God's eyes. He looked from God's perspective and immediately saw to the heart of the matter. From F.B. Meyer's commentary, reflects on these verses this way. On arriving at the trenches, he found the army in battle array, not daring to advance. When the whole story was told to the young shepherd, he looked at the incident and challenged it from the spiritual side. This event, therefore, marked the turning point not only in his own history, but in that of all of his people. At least one was found in their ranks who looked at things from God's standpoint, counted on God, the ancient of the covenant, and was prepared to venture all on faith. He saw the spiritual truth of the matter when he arrived at this battle. David based his actions on that, not on the physical appearance of Goliath, and not on all the fear that was felt and being described from the Israeli army. In our battles too, we have to make sure that we keep our vision clear. And we do that by seeing things from God's perspective. When we look at things from a human perspective, we look at things the same way Saul's army did, and we don't see a way out. We don't see a solution. But we have to learn to see things from God's perspective and not a physical perspective. And this perspective comes from knowing God, studying his word, his plan of salvation, his purpose for his people. And by doing that, we build trust in God and we see his plan. When we trust God, we start to see things differently. Things become more clear, and we look at them from maybe an unconventional perspective. When we see clearly from God's perspective, we're not sidetracked or dazzled by the appearance of things, but we can see the spiritual truth of matters, and then we can act accordingly. It is a great advantage, but it only comes through the seeming disadvantage of not seeing things the way everyone else does. When we see things through God's perspective, we start to see things and think about things differently. Picking it back up in verse 28, skipping down to verse 28. Now, Eliab, his older brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and your insolence of your heart, for you came down here to see the battle." Eliab points out here that he considers David to be small and inadequate. And this is also how the world treats us. It's not just how they treat us, it's how they view us. They think that we're small-minded because we believe in the living God. They think that we're really nobody because we place our faith in God and we believe that he's our creator. And they think that we're also small-minded because we believe that we should actually do what he says. Eliab is a good representation of this. He says, "What are you doing here?" Basically, he's telling David, "You don't belong here. You don't know anything. You don't know what you're doing." How many times have people said similar things to us? How many times have we felt like we didn't belong somewhere because somebody treated us differently because we do believe in God and we do put our faith in God? How many times do we feel that way? Probably a lot, because I mentioned before, we don't belong here. We're part of God's kingdom, and we're waiting for that. Eliab said, "With whom have you left those few sheep?" He belittles David's work and responsibilities. I remember a lot of times when I travel in Africa, you see a lot of children herding goats or sheep, and there are a lot of them. And so from that perspective, you can understand that you see these herders everywhere, and usually people send their children out to do these menial jobs. And here Eliab is pointing out to David that you have this nothing job. Who are you? You're not important. And not only are you lowly, you're a shepherd. And not only are you a shepherd, but you only have a few sheep. You're not that responsible. You can't possibly know anything about what's going on here. Eliab told him, he said, I know your pride. Actually, David showed quite a bit of restraint and maturity here in the way he responded to his brother. Verse 29. And David said, "What have I done now?" You can kind of tell his brother's talking to him. He's, "What have I done now?" He says, "Is there not a cause?" And he just leaves it at that. Then he turned from him and toward another, and he said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. David seems shocked that no one else sees what he does. It's so clear to him. It's right there in front of him. He doesn't understand this. They saw things differently than David did. So what they were doing didn't make any sense to David. And that applies to us in the same way. When God calls us and gives us his truth and shows us how we are supposed to be doing things, when we see people out in the world and the way that they act and the decisions they make, it doesn't make any sense to us because we know better, because we have God's truth. David was experiencing something similar here. These men of Israel, including Eliab, those men of Israel, including Eliab, who had been present for these 40 days, they may have not been professional soldiers accustomed to battle. But if nothing else, they'd been trained by these last 40 days. And seeing the way the army reacted to these taunts and reacted to Goliath, conditioned them, and they followed suit. They had their conventions, and that's the way they had settled into this battle, and they conformed to that, and they didn't challenge that. That's how the progression is in the world for us. Those out there, those in the world, they've accepted the training that they've received from the world, from Satan's influence. And they've accepted that there's a certain way the world does things. And if you're going to go along with the flow, this is how you see things. And that leads to doing things in a certain way. And if you want to succeed in this world that we live in, we have to conform to the world's conventions. And that's a great advantage if you want to live in this world and you want things to go smoothly. But the training in the wrong way, if we allow ourselves to be trained in the wrong way, in the world's ways, we're going to be blinded by God's truth. Learning to see things the way the world sees them and agree with them dulls our vision. It dulls God's truth. And with dull vision, we won't be able to take the right action. We won't know how to, because we won't see things the way David did. We won't see the things the way God does from his perspective. So we have to make sure that we keep clear vision, a clear vision of what God's perspective is. David's actions were in sharp contrast to those around him because he did have clear vision. Verse 31. Now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him," referring to the Philistine Goliath. "Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And this is David's advantage, his second advantage. He did not conform to the conventions of those around him. His clear, godly perspective led him to act in a way that was strikingly different from all those that are around him. If you want to join me in Romans 12, you might want to put your finger here, and 1 Samuel will be coming back to that. But Romans chapter 12, we'll be reading verses 1 through 3. David did not conform to the world around him. Conform means to make yourself like them or to make yourself the same shape. To see, to think, to do, and act like them. One of the lessons we want to draw out here is to not be trained by the world. Of course, we need an education and job skills, but to know where wisdom actually comes from is important for us to understand, for us to be able to think differently and do differently and be different. We are all called to be different. God refers to his people as salt, and he refers to his people as light. And those things change the things that they're around because they are different. And God has called us to be that way. Romans 12, verse 1. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt with each one a measure of faith." This is exactly what David did. He came to the situation. He did not conform to the views of everyone around him. He didn't think the way they think or thinking. And he didn't alter the way he thought because he was thinking differently. He clearly saw the good and acceptable will of God, as we read here in Romans. He wasn't thinking of himself more highly than he should have. He was thinking according to faith. He knew that God knew what to do, and he knew who to rely on. Back in 1 Samuel 17, going back to 1 Samuel 17, verse 33. And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You are a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." Once again, we see this conventional thinking. You can't do this. Saul saw David's inexperience in youth. He saw Goliath's power and armor and weapons. Saul was looking at the outward appearance and was blind to God's perspective. He couldn't see what God could do there or would do there. Verse 34. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I struck it. And when it rose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." David cites his experience here. David knows he is actually prepared for this battle. The third advantage of David. He had developed skills and tools through his daily God-given opportunities and experiences. He had developed skills and tools through his daily God-given opportunities and experiences. He has no experience or training in combat, but that didn't matter to him. He knows he didn't know how to be a warrior at that point in his life, because the experience he had was different. God had given him skills that made him uniquely prepared for the situation. David is not looking at the skills he does not have. He's not thinking, "I don't have the training of a soldier. I don't know what I'm doing." He looks at his experiences and skills that he's developed, and he's confident. He tells himself, "I have the tools here to work with. I've dealt with challenges before. I know how to do this." God often gives us tools. He gives us the tools that we need before we know we need them. It's our job to make sure that we take the time to develop those tools every chance that we get. Through our everyday experiences, our job, school, interaction with family and strangers, through trials and tests, God gives us opportunities to develop the skills that we're going to need in this life and the next. God is giving us opportunities to develop spiritual skills and godly character. We need to be focused on developing these skills, using these opportunities we are given, and practicing these tools purposefully, knowing that God wants us to use them for his good. Thinking back to the story of the basketball team, Renadeev said that his girls had to be fitter than all the other players, than all the other teams. He would make them run, run, and run. He said he made them run hard every practice. This was the only way, he said, they could win. They worked hard and developed the one tool they had, which was their relentless defense. He said, the strategy worked. He said, the strategy was hard, but it worked. And that is the point here. Hard work works. When it comes to developing skills, it's something God expects us to work hard at, to develop the skills he wants us to develop in this life. We're to be striving for excellence in everything God's given us to do. I believe that came from Nate Zimmerman's sermonette just before the feast. Striving for excellence in all that God has given us to do. God gives us opportunities to develop skills and character. Like the girls on Renative's basketball team, we have to know our part and do our part and work hard at the skills God needs from us or wants from us. And as we develop these tools, we might not know which tool we'll need at any given battle until the moment of battle. We've got to be developing them every chance we get. Continuing the story in verse 37. Moreover, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." All the skills David has are secondary to this. He says, "The Lord will deliver me." David's fourth advantage, he had absolute trust in God. His fourth advantage, he had absolute trust in God. David trusted God to protect him, but also what David knows here is that God's honor is at stake. Goliath has defied God, and David's certain that God will put a stop to that. He has no doubt. It is this faith in God that made it possible for David to think the way that he did. David couldn't think along these lines if he didn't believe God and have faith in him and trust him. If David hadn't built a deep relationship with God, a faith in God, it never would have occurred to him to step on that scene and possibly challenge Goliath. It wouldn't have been something that came into his mind. Our ability to have a godly perspective and clear vision is in direct proportion with our trust in God. We have to be developing our personal trust in God. We have to have a relationship, a one-on-one relationship with God, in such a way that when we face our Goliaths, when we face our trials, we know who God is because we know him personally. And we trust him. We know we can lean out on that, and we know we can count on it. That's what David had. He had a personal relationship with God. He had faith that God was going to do this. He had complete confidence. David lets Saul know that he's not interested in wearing his armor. And with that, it's time for the battle. Verse 40. Then he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself five smooth stones. He chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Another quote from Malcolm Gladwell: "Ancient times had three kinds of warriors. The first was cavalry, armed men on horseback and chariots. The second was infantry, foot soldiers, wearing armor and carrying swords and shields. The third were projectile warriors, or what today would be called artillery, archers and slingers. Slinging took an extraordinary amount of skill and practice, but in experienced hands, a sling was a devastating weapon." You don't have to turn there, but in Judges 20:16, speaking about the men of the Benjamite army, it says this: "All these people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss." If you took the time or take the time or have taken the time to study slingers in the Bible or study slingers in history, it's an amazing and fascinating study in how powerful they are, the distance they can actually sling a stone or a lead ball, or sometimes they would make porcelain balls or clay balls as their ammunition. It's a fascinating study to see how deadly and accurate they were. Continuing the quote, "An experienced slinger could kill or seriously injure a target at a distance of up to 200 yards. The three kinds of warriors," this is continuing the quote still, "the three kinds of warriors balanced one another. With their long spikes and armor, infantry could stand up to cavalry. Cavalry, in turn, could defeat projectile warriors because the horses moved too quickly for the artillery to take proper aim. And projectile warriors were deadly against infantry because a big lumbering soldier weighed down with armor was a sitting duck for a slinger who could launch his projectiles from 100 yards away. Goliath is heavy infantry. He thinks he's going to be engaged in a duel with another infantryman. When Saul tries to dress David in his armor and give him a sword, he is operating under the same assumption. He assumes David is going to fight Goliath hand to hand. David, however, has no intention of honoring the rituals of single combat. He intends to fight Goliath the same way he has learned to fight animals, as a projectile warrior." It's the end of the quote. So with his sling, and more importantly, with his experience and practice and hard work with this sling, the practice he's put in with this skill, David was well equipped for this battle. He was far from an underdog. He was very far from an underdog. Even more than this, it was David's heart and his attitude that equipped him for this job. God is developing in us, combined with our effort, the different talents and the skills that we need as we go through this life and the next. And most importantly, God is working with us to develop our hearts so that we're able to have the heart and the attitude of David. Back to the story. Verse 41. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David. And the man bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." Here we see that there is no holding back on Goliath's part, no sympathy or regard for youth. And this is how the world treats us. And it's how it treats our children. It's not pleasant how the world treats us as Christians or regards us, but it's something that we're aware of and something that we need to be aware of. On underneath that is what is Satan's hatred for us. Satan hates us. And he doesn't just want us to die or to kill us. He wants us to be humiliated, and he wants us to suffer before that happens. And Goliath is a good representation of that. Goliath here, though, truly was the underdog. But nobody could see it because they had conventional thinking. We, as the called of God, having the right attitude, having the right heart, we are all Davids in a world full of Goliaths. Giants that will and do stand in the way of the people of God and against God's way of life. It's important for us to understand the principle here is Goliaths don't stand a chance, but they can't see that because they can't see that this isn't a conventional basketball game they're playing. We are God's people, and God is the one that will deliver us. The battle is the Lord's. And when we go out and face our Goliaths in the world, that's something they don't understand. That's something they can't see right now. Verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, You have come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you defied." David speaks the simple truth here. He does not draw attention to himself. He's not thinking about himself. This, again, is David's main advantage. To him, it is all about God. It's about God's honor. He's honoring God through his actions here. And this is about God's power. He knows it's not his power. Mind you, David knows that he is an expert slinger. And I don't think David thought for a second that he didn't have the talent to pull this off. But he knew that it was God that provided all of this. And he knew that it was God that was going to make sure of the outcome. He's not saying you've messed with the wrong guy or even you've messed with the wrong nation. David doesn't say that. He says, basically, you've messed with the wrong God. And Goliath had no idea what he was getting himself into. And this is our main advantage as well. When we're focused on God, and we're focused on his way of life, living his way of life, and we keep his plan in mind, we keep the plan of God relevant so we know why we're living his way of life, and it causes us to grow in our character, and it prepares us for God's purpose for us. Our focus on our own desire starts to fade when we do this, when we follow this train of thought. And with that, our fear also fades. It's a natural cause and effect. Our fear fades as well. Our heart becomes more aligned with God's, becomes more aligned with God's thinking, and our attitude is right when we're doing this. When we fear God and hold God in high esteem like David did, there's nothing else for us to fear. There is nothing as big as God, so giants are no longer a threat to us. Continuing on in verse 46. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth. And all the earth will know that there is a God in Israel. Then all the assembly shall know that the Lord God, that the Lord does not," verse 47, "then all the assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." The key here, as I mentioned in the very beginning, the key here in all of this is the battle is the Lord's. David's trust in God gave him the perspective he needed to do this. Clear, godly vision to the spiritual, heart of the matter. He knew what was being defied here, and he knew what needed to happen to stop it. David's trust in God allowed him to see how he was uniquely prepared with the skills to engage in this battle. David's trust in God gave him the heart and courage to step out and meet that challenge. Verse 48. "And it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to David that David hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine." He runs towards Goliath because without armor, he has speed and he has maneuverability. What could Goliath do at this point with David running down the hill at him? He was carrying over 100 pounds of armor. He was prepared for a battle at close range where he could stand immobile, wielding off blows with his armor and delivering mighty thrusts with his spear. He watched David approach, first with scorn, then with surprise, and then with only what can be described as horror, as it dawned on him that the battle that he was expecting had suddenly changed shape. This is from Adam Clark's commentary. In the use of a sling, it requires much practice to hit the mark. But once this dexterity is acquired, the sling is nearly as fatal as a musket blow. David, evidently an expert marksman, and his sling gave him greatly the advantage over Goliath, and an advantage of which the giant does not seem to have been aware of. He could hit him from within any speaking distance. If he missed, he had as many chances as he did stones. And after all, being unencumbered with armor, young and athletic, he could have saved his life by flight. Against him, the Philistine could do but little, except at close fight. It is true he appears to have had a javelin or missile spear, but David took care to prevent the use of all such weapons by giving him the first blow. Verse 49. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sunk into his forehead and he fell on his face to the earth. There's another quote from Malcolm Gladwell. David reaches into his shepherd's bag for a stone, and at that point, no one watching from the ridges on either side of the valley would have considered David's victory improbable. David was a slinger, and slingers beat infantry, hands down. Goliath had as much of a chance, sorry, this is from a historian that wrote this about this account. Goliath had as much of a chance against David as any bronze warrior with a sword would have had against an opponent armed with a 45 automatic pistol. So we can see truly that David was not the underdog in this fight. Verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. But with no sword in the hand of David, therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it from its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. It is the same for us, brethren. Though we may appear to be underdogs, God has equipped us with every advantage we need for us to go into battle against the Goliaths we face in this world. Like a slinger against infantry, God wins. No problem. Hands down. Every time. Well, stop the story there. I'd like to close by summarizing the advantages that we saw of David's, which are also our advantages. The first advantage that David has or had, David saw God's perspective, so he was able to see the heart, the spiritual truth of matters. The second advantage, he did not conform to the conventions of the world around him or those around him. Number three, he developed skills, tools, and the right heart through daily life and God-given experiences. And four, most important, he had absolute trust in God. Brethren, when we're faced with giants, remember, despite the appearances, we are the ones with every advantage. When you feel you're facing a giant, recenter, refocus, and remind yourself who God is. We can all be Davids in this world of Goliaths.